But godly wisdom that comes from on high is first of all pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy, good-hearted, humble, impartial, and sincere. And these are the things that we ought to be seeking as we go through life.
Welcome to Mission 66, a ministry of TWR and Dr. Luis Seau. Today, we're in the book of 1 Kings and the royal court of David and Solomon. You can follow along with your downloadable study guide. Pick it up at mission66.org. Let's join teacher John Matthews and co-host Esther Sisulu for our discussion.
Today, our chapter-by-chapter look in the Bible takes us into the history of ancient Israel during the time of the kings. Now, this is the first book of Kings, and we're going to look at chapters 3 and 4, and it's all about King Solomon. Well, here is our teacher, John Matthews, who will guide our understanding in these chapters with the theme, Wisdom from on High.
Esther, thank you so much, and a very warm welcome to Mission 66, wherever you're joining us from today. It is so good to have your company, and it's just so good to be with you as we get into our study of King Solomon's reign, which was, well, look, one of the most prosperous of times for Israel. We'd seen David expand the nation militarily, but his son Solomon was to have a different kind of rule. And the Bible tells us what Solomon's reign was like. And these passages, beginning in chapter 3, say that Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. And he brought her to the city of David until he finished building his palace and the temple of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. The people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because a temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. So Solomon inherited the kingdom from David, a kingdom which had already been established, all enemies defeated. And so, boy, is he facing a favourable scenario. And in chapter 4, it says that he had 12 district governors over all Israel who supplied provisions for the king and the royal household. Each one had to provide supplies for 1 month in the year. And this extraordinary reign, which is going to be, in terms of material wealth, the richest, and also in terms of international relations, the richest. Solomon here even weds the princess of Egypt. And in verse 20 of chapter 4, it says, the people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. These countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subjects all his life. Now today, the state of Israel is a little over 20,000 square kilometres. Well, the kingdom of Solomon was about five times larger than that. So Solomon lived and led in this golden age of the kingdom, which he'd inherited from his father David. And the Bible tells us in chapter 3, verse 4, that the king went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices, for that was the most important high place. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream. And God asked, ask for whatever you want me to give you. And Solomon answered, you have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, Lord, my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, but I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So, give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? And the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, since you have asked for this, and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Goodness, what a seal of approval that is from the God of the universe. Solomon could have asked, couldn't he, for glory, honour, fame, riches, the destruction of his enemies. But Solomon already reveals plenty of wisdom in asking here for wisdom. In humility, he asks for wisdom. He shows he's a man of humility at this point. He says he's too young. I don't know what to do. I'm too young. So he puts himself before God and recognizes that he needs discernment. He needs wisdom. Everyone who sees their need for wisdom is already revealing some wisdom. And God, who is a very wise God, clearly understands that he can bless Solomon in a special way, more than what he'd asked for. And so verse 13 says, this is the Lord carrying on to say to Solomon, moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both wealth and honour, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. And if you walk in obedience to me and keep my decrees and commands, as David your father did, I will give you a long life. Then Solomon awoke, and he realized it had been a dream. And with this, now that Solomon has been granted the wisdom that he asked for through this special blessing from God, we are going to see this wisdom being put to use. It didn't take long either for Solomon's wisdom to be tested, for the Bible says that two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. And one of them said, pardon me, my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I had a baby while she was there with me. The third day after my child was born, this woman also had a baby. We were alone. There was no one in the house, but just the two of us. And during the night, this woman's son died because she lay on him. So she got up in the middle of the night and took my son from my side while I, your servant, was asleep. And she put him by her breast and put her dead son by my breast. And the next morning I got up to nurse my son, and he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning light, I saw that it wasn't the son I had born. But the other woman said, no, the living one is my son, the dead one is yours. But the first one insisted, no, the dead one is yours, the living one is mine. And so they argued before the king. And the king said, this one says, my son is alive and your son is dead, while that one says, no, your son is dead and mine is alive. And then the king said, bring me a sword. So they brought a sword for the king, and he then gave an order, cut the living child in two, give half to one and half to the other. But the woman whose son was alive was deeply moved out of love for her son and said to the king, please, my lord, give her the living baby. Don't kill him. But the other said, neither I nor you shall have him. Cut him in two. And then the king gave his ruling. Give the living baby to the first woman. Do not kill him. She is his mother. Wisdom is the capacity to solve problems in unforeseen circumstances. So much more, isn't it, than culture, than intelligence, than the ability to understand the details and the visible elements. And so everyone getting word of this from this point on were in awe of the king's wisdom, and there's a great deal of respect growing for him. And that's why chapter 4 ends by saying that God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the people of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than anyone else, including Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Heman, Calcol, and Dara, the sons of Mahol. And his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. And now look at Solomon's artistic wisdom. He spoke 3,000 proverbs. His songs numbered 1,005. And whoever said that science is modern, born a few centuries ago, in special moments of civilization? Well, no, because Solomon spoke about plant life, from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also spoke about animals and birds, reptiles and fish, botany, biology, with Solomon and his wisdom. From all nations, people came to listen to Solomon's wisdom sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. Maybe as you listen, you're thinking, what will become of my future? What is God going to give me tomorrow? What do I really need from God? Well, ask God for his wisdom and the eyes to see just a little of what he sees.
You're listening to Mission 66 with our teacher, John Matthews. Well, my name is Esther, and I'm here to ask questions that will spur our discussion on as we seek to understand 1 Kings chapters 3 and 4. Now, John, you know, as you describe what's happening in Israel at the time, it really seems like Israel under Solomon was in this kind of golden age, right? But I think at the heart of it, or at least behind the scenes, not all was truly golden, was it?
No, that is quite right, Esther. It's a really good point to make. Solomon's reign, you're right, was considered a golden age in terms of political and economic achievements, and to a certain extent in religious matters as well, if we include the building of the Great Temple. But you're right, because what we're going to discover is that it seems that the nation never quite manages to fully heal or manage to cast off this wander towards idolatry. Isn't idolatry and pride the utter bane of humanity? And this, whilst we have God himself beckoning us home to a place where our need to worship and be fully known is perfectly complete in him, and the place where our need for humility is fully understood to the extent that our pride is blown away. And the Bible describes the so-called sacred sites or high places, which were hills where sacrifices had been made, and originally these were pagan worship sites. Now, what we don't know, and this is where a degree of debate lies, is whether some of these altars on the high place were acceptable or permitted. There is a term known as syncretism, which is a mixture of good religious practices with bad. In other words, worshipping God in heaven according to his law, but also attaching and adopting other religious ideas alongside it. And now we know that the Canaanites, the original inhabitants of the land, they really influenced many of the Israelites arriving, many of the Hebrews, into their idolatry. And so this was a disease within the nation. It continued to hinder the nation, even as the very temple itself was being constructed, even with the triumphal shouting and celebration of faith, where everything was seemingly as good as it was going to get and in order. And yet the people keep engaging in these practices a little by little that bring them closer to the idols of the Canaanites and enable their drift away from God. There was prostitution as well. It was really prevalent and common within Baal worship. And we read then, don't we, about the two prostitutes who appealed to Solomon in their case. And, you know, in Israel, prostitution was forbidden, yet apparently tolerated. And so we see spiritual and moral issues continuing to undermine the nation. You know, the great reformer John Calvin once said, every one of us is, even from his mother's womb, a master craftsman of idols. Man's nature, so to speak, is a perpetual factory of idols. And we have this steer in our human nature to go after idols. What might they be today? Wealth, idolizing other people, idolizing people in our family, when actually we have no need to do that, because we have God who has all the answers to our deepest, deepest longings. And he promises to take us home to be with him if we believe on what his son Jesus has achieved and did achieve on the cross.
You know, John, keeping in the same vein, there was a law that said that the Israelites were not supposed to intermarry with foreigners. But I find it interesting here that Solomon goes ahead and he marries Pharaoh's daughter.
Well, Esther, here's the thing here. They weren't supposed to intermarry outside of the faith. Now, an Israelite could marry anybody as long as they were willing to adopt the faith of Israel. Such was the importance and obviously the truth of that faith. Otherwise, you water things down and you compromise. And as we saw when the Israelites came into the land, they end up following the Canaanites and drifting away from God. So that's the reason and the thinking behind it. The issue is not racial nor ethnic. It's about loyalty to God, but also drawing close to the God who has our very best interest at heart, by far. We have examples, don't we, of Rahab from Jericho adopting the faith of Israel. Ruth, the Moabite, marries into Israel, adopts the worship of God, and possibly Pharaoh's daughter could have converted to God, at least openly. It doesn't say. You know, Solomon's marriage to her may have been what they call a marriage of convenience in order to secure treaties with other nations. So we don't know. But where the Israelites get into trouble was when they intermarry and they start worshipping the Baals, the idols of their Canaanite spouses. And even Solomon himself would fall into sin over that very issue. And we'll come to that later on in his life.
Right. Okay, well, you know, speaking of this wisdom, we know that God had given Solomon this extraordinary wisdom, but we can say that there is a difference between having wisdom and being well-informed or having information, right?
Absolutely, Esther. And education is often about opportunity, and we live in a world which is not a level playing field in terms of opportunity, far, far from it. But you're right, a person could be educated at the very best schools, have access to the best knowledge, online digital wealth, huge libraries, be cultured, sophisticated, considered intelligent, and yet be far from wise. Solomon wrote in his Proverbs that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. But sometimes we see people despise wisdom and instruction. And, you know, what is that? Well, that's foolish. And so we should always be seeking to know what is true. And that means we need truth. How important truth is in a post-truth world. Information that is right. Wisdom is the ability to know what to do with the truth. What do we do with the truth? And what do we say about it?
Yeah, you know, I suppose we could say that people who may not necessarily be learned or cultured can still act wisely.
Yeah, of course. Solomon finds out that wisdom is more important than any gold, silver, and jewelry in the world. You know, he demonstrates a beginning of wisdom when he asks God for that very thing. So there's already a seed of wisdom within him. And then God recognizing that he can be entrusted with what comes with the gift of wisdom gives him even more because he can be trusted.
John, would you say that it is a little hard to define exactly what wisdom is?
Yeah, it is. It is. But true wisdom, and there is no wisdom apart from true wisdom, Esther, that's the truth. True wisdom, and that is the wisdom of God, is the antithesis of what the world considers to be wisdom. Great philosopher Socrates once said, "True wisdom comes to each of us when we realize how little we understand about life, about ourselves, and about the world around us." Isn't that anti-cultural? True wisdom comes to us when we are humble, when we have this awareness of how little we know about life, how little we know about ourselves, the complexities of our own nature, how little we understand really about how the world around us works, the universe. This is what American speaker and Christian author John Piper said about this. He said, "Here is an indispensable path to wisdom. Become a fool that you may become wise." Paul says we must happily embrace the role of fool in the world in order to become wise. We must not be ashamed of being a fool for Christ. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 that the wisdom of this world is folly to God. And one day, God will destroy the wisdom of the wise. And so 1 Corinthians 3:18 says, "And so God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. Therefore," and this is 1 Corinthians 3 verse 18, "become a fool that you may become wise." And that connects with Socrates' quote when he says, "The start of wisdom is when we are totally humble, realizing how little we know." So let's be very wary about the whole idea of you need to know it all, right? Because that's a path of pride, and it's as far from wisdom, which aligns with the path of humility, as you can possibly get. Proverbs 16:16, written by Solomon, says, "To get wisdom is better than gold." Why? Gold? Well, it can buy almost anything in the world, but it cannot buy that which is so much more valuable than anything the world offers. It cannot buy everlasting life and joy. When we give up our quest, Esther, for finding wisdom in the world around us, and look to the author of wisdom to humbly give us wisdom, then he gifts it to us. Do you see? It can't be bought nor acquired. And that's why true, real wisdom is rare, because it requires us throwing away our pride, becoming a fool by the yardstick of the world, and surrendering ourselves to God. And just look at the characteristics of true wisdom. They're listed in James chapter 3. This is what it says. "But godly wisdom that comes from on high is first of all pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy, good-hearted, humble, impartial, and sincere. These are the things," says James, "that we ought to be seeking as we go through life."
Oh, I am in awe, and I love how the Bible so beautifully describes the immeasurable treasure that is wisdom. So to the one who asks themselves or asks God, how can they know when they have godly wisdom?
Well, look, there's no objective way to measure it, that's for sure. But there's no doubt that people who really want godly wisdom and ask with a truly, and I mean truly humble heart, with the desire at the heart of that request to become more like Jesus, so that they use that wisdom for his glory. Well, God said, ask and you will receive if you ask in my name. So God can impart to us what to do and say, he can. And then what happens? Well, either they sense the change within themselves. You know what it's like when you respond with something that is, yeah, it's from outside of yourself. More likely than that, others will discern it within them. You know, one of the hallmarks of true wisdom, and this is an absolute, well, this is one of those things that really can make us wonder whether somebody is wise or not, is humility. True wisdom is humble.
Beautifully said there, John. And, you know, I think that's all I have for you today. Perhaps now we can move into the closing summary of these two chapters.
Yeah, let's do that, Esther. So we covered, didn't we, chapters 3 and 4 of the first book of Kings, and our theme was wisdom from on high. When we look at King Solomon's reign, well, it marked a golden age for Israel, which was characterized by and large by peace, prosperity, and his own request and gift for wisdom. Solomon asked God not for wealth nor for power, but for wisdom, in order to govern Israel justly. And God was really pleased with the humility of the request, and so he not only grants him unparalleled wisdom, but he also blesses him with the riches and the honour that he didn't ask for. And we then see Solomon's wisdom swiftly put to the test in this case of two women who claim to be the mother of the same child. And his discerning judgment reveals the true mother. And word gets around, and people are left, really, the nation are left in awe because of this God-given insight. And Solomon's wisdom also extended to intellectual pursuits as he composed thousands of proverbs. We'll get to some of those here on Mission 66. And, you know, as the Bible says, if any of you lacks wisdom, come to God for it. Well, we'll come into the Bible and the words of God, and that will help us so much to learn what wisdom looks like and how to deal with real life situations. That's coming up on Mission 66 when we get to Proverbs. Also, he composed many songs and he studies the natural world, and people come from all over the known world just to listen to his words. And yet, Solomon's reign's also marked by underlying spiritual moral challenges here within Israel. And despite the building of a temple for God, the nation struggles with idolatry. It continues to struggle. Almost its Achilles heel throughout its history. And it blends the worship of Jehovah with pagan practices. But wisdom, as highlighted in Solomon's life, well, it's distinct from intelligence or knowledge. We all know, don't we, people who are very highly educated but lack wisdom. Godly wisdom, which is the only wisdom that there is, begins with the fear of the Lord. And how does it manifest itself? Well, it manifests itself in purity, in humility, and peace. As Solomon himself wrote, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Amen. What a great way to end off today's episode of Mission 66. I hope that you've been blessed, friend. I certainly have. And we're looking forward to having you join us next time, same place, as we move on into the next chapters of 1 Kings. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Esther for John and our team, saying until next time, thank you and God bless you.
As Mission 66 comes to a close, be sure to download your free study guide at mission66.org. deepen your daily devotion with insights from each episode, and let John and Esther lead you through the Scriptures. Get your study guide at mission66.org and be prepared for our next episode. There, you can also connect with us, ask questions, or donate to help Mission 66's worldwide outreach. Head to mission66.org. Mission 66 is made possible through Transworld Radio in partnership with Dr. Luis Seau.